This is an interview with Barbara Lucas for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is June 4th, 2012. We're talking at Luness Partners' office in New York City. Ms. Lucas, thank you very much for talking with us today. Just to start off, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and I grew up in the New York metropolitan area.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a lawyer when you grew up?
Strangely enough, yes, I did. I think it was probably watching Perry Mason in the 50s, always seeing him solve his case in the last 5 minutes of the show. But I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer.
Were either of your parents lawyers or businessmen or finance?
No, my father was a dentist. My mother was a housewife. My parents thought that I would become a teacher because that's what women did at the time. And they were surprised when I went to law school.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Cornell University.
What did you study there?
I was an English major and a government minor.
But you were already thinking about studying law?
Yes.
Did you have sort of a specialty in mind? I mean, did you imagine that you'd be working on finance and securities issues?
I thought I was going to save the world. It was the 60s, and I never imagined myself representing big corporations or being involved in finance.
Okay. So where did you go to law school?
I went to American University.
In Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
And while you were there, did you take courses that specialized in securities law?
Never. I took all of the clinical programs, volunteering in prisons, and helping tenants in landlord-tenant court. I had no understanding whatsoever of business or finance, and at the time, no interest in it.
Okay. Did you have any law professors that maybe influenced your career path?
It was completely haphazard.
Okay. As it is for a lot of people, I guess. So tell me how you got from law school to the SEC.
When I finished law school, my first job was clerking for an appellate judge on the D.C. Court of Appeals. And of course, by definition, that's a temporary job. You do that for a little over a year. And as I came to the end of the clerkship, I really had no concept of what I wanted to do, but I still believed that I wanted to save the world. And a friend of mine who had clerked for a judge on the same court had joined the SEC, and he called me one day and he said, "I've made an appointment for you. You have an interview next Wednesday morning, be there at 10 o'clock. They just lifted a hiring freeze, and you've got to be there." And I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know what this agency does." We had lunch. He gave me the five-minute overview, and I walked into the commission, and I interviewed with Alan Levinson, who was the director of the division of Corp Fin. And for no particular reason, other than fate, I guess, he hired me that day. And when he did, he looked me in the eye and he said, "I'm hiring you and I want you to come here and I want you to be a star." And I said, "Oh my goodness, you know, Alan wants me to come here and he wants me to be a star. I've got to do it." Mm-hmm. And that was how I got there.
What year was that?
That was 1973.
Okay. So just to go back real quickly to ask you about your experience in the appellate court in D.C. That must have been a very, very interesting time to be working in the court in D.C.
It was a wonderful time to be working in a court. First of all, being in an appellate court is a wonderful education, because any decent appeal can be decided either way. And the judge I worked for would participate in the panel of judges deciding a case after the oral arguments, but she would never tell me what the panel had decided. And so my job was to go off and draft an opinion without the benefit of knowing what the court had decided. And it was a wonderful way, it was a very luxurious way to study the law and to see how courts worked. It was also in the era of public demonstrations. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of cases coming out of the mass arrests in the District of mm-hmm. Columbia, people wanting to have their records expunged, people challenging the constitutionality of the process mm-hmm. by which they had been held in the baseball stadium for days on end. I looked out the window one day. The judge called me to come stand and look out the window with her, and we saw the Watergate defendants who were being taken to their arraignment. So it was a very charged political time and a very wonderful experience for a young lawyer.
Okay, so just to get back to the SEC now, you started in the division of Corp Fin. What was your introduction to that like? Was there any training, or did they just throw you on cases?
They just threw me in. I was in the branch that reviewed real estate tax shelters, which were very big at that time, and which were offered by people who thought that they were in the real estate business and not in the securities business. And so there were a lot of conflicts with our issuers. There were a lot of offerings that wound up being referred to enforcement. It was an interesting way to learn about the limits of disclosure versus merit regulation. It was an interesting way to see how the division operated when it didn't like what was being proposed to be offered to the public. Mm-hmm. In terms of training, none. Learn on the job. Somebody handed me a 10K. It must have had 300 pages in it. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this? And he lifted it up to his ear and he ran his thumb over the pages. He said, if it sounds good, let it go. And that was really the way we operated.
Yeah. So do you think that most of the people within division, do they have the knowledge of finance to be able to go through these types of forms and understand them?
I doubt it. I think I probably knew less than anybody else mm-hmm. because I had not studied securities law and I had not studied finance. I think most of the people at the commission were there because of an interest in finance, but did anybody know what they were doing? Not really.
Okay. Yep. So how long did you work on these real estate tax shelters?
I was in the branch for about a year.
Okay. And then what was your next step within the
And then
SEC?
I was hired by Irv Pollack. He had recently been appointed to the commission, and I was his first hire as a legal assistant. And so it was just a wonderful opportunity to work with a man whose voice still echoes in my head.
Mm-hmm. Did you switch over to the Division of Enforcement at that point?
No. He was a member of the commission.
Oh, he's a member of the commission. That's
so
right.
So I became okay. his legal right. assistant. So, uh-huh. By that time, Stanley Sporkin had right. replaced him as the director okay. of so. Enforcement, and I was working for Irv. And the thing about working for Irv was that he had this very unusual definition of the job of a legal assistant. My job was to learn from him, and his job was to teach me and other young lawyers at the commission, because he was creating a cadre of people who would then go out and represent the public interest in their private practices. And I was in a uniquely gifted position because I worked for him for about, I'd say about a year and a half in that position. And after that, he started rotating legal assistants for very short stints. He brought people in from the regional offices so that he could share the wealth, so that more people could have this experience. So I was the one who had him the longest, and it was one of the most glorious experiences of my professional life. It was just wonderful. The whole world would come to his door, and the things that were very significant that were going on in those days we were unfixing commission rates after years of contentious hearings and rule proposals. And I can remember the officials from the New York Stock Exchange coming to the building to lobby, and they had their big stretch limos, and they made no progress with her whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He taught me a very puritanical ethic that was characteristic of the commission. He would never allow anybody from the regulated business to take him to lunch. So Felix Roatan, who at that point was working on issues coming out of the financial problems of New York City, would come to the office, and he would stay for lunch. Our secretary would run downstairs to the grocery store and buy a loaf of white bread, and take old file folders and turn them inside out and use them for placemats. And we had a jar of generic peanut butter that we would use. And I was always part of it. I would always sit and listen, and Felix Roatan would come, and he would take a piece of yellow paper, and he would show in a diagram how to solve the energy crisis, or how to restructure Lockheed, or what the solution to New York City's problems were. And it was just an extraordinary room to be allowed to be in.
The visitors to his office must have been quite surprised to see this sort of treatment in Washington, right? Or were they?
Oh,
were they just sort of expected? Did his reputation precede him?
Well, everybody knew Irv, and everybody knew what he was like, and people had tremendous respect for him and personal friendship, mm-hmm. even though they understood that there was a limit to how much that meant in terms of changing his position on an issue. But there was a wonderful man named Sam Lyons who represented the New York Stock Exchange for many, many years. And he knew that Irv's position on New York Stock Exchange issues wasn't the same as his. But he would come, and with great affection, they would spend time together. Anybody who was significant in the securities industry was in that office, mm-hmm. and so it was just a learning experience beyond any that I've had since, and one that I'll always treasure.
And Irv Pollack, during this period, became involved in the Watergate investigation too, right?
Well, Irv was involved in Watergate in several different ways. He had been at the commission when Brad Cook, who had been chairman, had perjured himself in front of Congress regarding whether or not the White House had ever tried to interfere in the Vesco investigation. And Irv had counseled him to resign and to own up to what he had done. Irv also was in the room when the call came from the administration with respect to halting the Vesco investigation. And Vesco was one of the big criminals of that period in time. And Irv and Stanley took the call together and made it clear that there was no way that they were going to subvert an investigation. Irv subsequently had to testify in the criminal trial of John Mitchell, who had been part of the committee to re-elect President Nixon, and who at that point was the Attorney General of the United States. And Mitchell was tried twice. He was tried once in New York City, and he was acquitted, and then he was tried again in Washington, and he was convicted. And Irv testified both times. But it was difficult for him to see Mitchell acquitted the first time, particularly when other people, including Brad Cook, had paid a very substantial price for perhaps lesser crimes. The other interesting sidelight on Irv's involvement in Watergate came from the fact that he had been appointed to the commission by Richard Nixon. And he believed that he had been appointed by Nixon because of his reputation for integrity, and because Nixon needed to show that he cared about integrity at that moment in time. It later came out when the Watergate tapes were released that Irvin Stanley had earned a mention in those tapes. Richard Nixon had referred to them as those Jew boys at the commission, and Irv took sort of a perverse pride in that fact. It was important to him that he had stood up to the White House.
So. That must have been quite a shock, but I guess a source of pride too. So after your time as Irv Pollack's legal assistant, where did you go next within the commission?
I went back to Corp Fin, and I was a special counsel first to Alan Levinson and then to Dick Rowe when he became the director. Mm-hmm. And so that was in the mid to late 70s. And the things that the division was very involved in at that point were the disclosure issues that went with the discovery that dozens and maybe hundreds of public companies were bribing foreign government officials and making illegal campaign contributions in the U.S. And so we developed an amnesty program so that companies could come in before they were found out by enforcement, and they could confess to their wrongs, and they could negotiate some disclosure language. And we did have, I think, several hundred companies eventually came in to do that. And of course, that eventually led to the enactment of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act,
right,
which we were heavily involved in.
Now, on the disclosure program, Stanley Sporkin is often given credit for instituting this program or initiating it. And of course, he was the director of enforcement. What role was Corp Fin playing in this process?
Well, we were the ones who were responsible for processing the disclosure. So it was really a joint effort of the two divisions, and we worked very closely with Stanley. The ones who didn't come in for the amnesty program wound up being the defendants in enforcement cases to the extent that they were caught. And we worked together to come up with disclosure. And it was a time when there was a lot of debate about what needed to be disclosed, because there were people who thought, and I guess still think, that the securities laws only require disclosure of matters that are economically material. And in the vast majority of cases, these payments were economically immaterial. But the commission at that point agreed that there were things that were qualitatively material, and that there should be disclosure on these matters. Not that it was without controversy. It was a difficult position for the commission to come to, and in the many discussions that took place at the commission table, there were commissioners who really struggled with the concept and eventually came around to it.
So that was something of a contentious issue at first.
It was very contentious, but it was also, and I think this is interesting historically in light of what happened to some of the commissions that followed, it was a truly collegial commission. When Ray Garrett was chairman, and Irv was on the commission, Phil Loomis was on the commission, Al Summers was on the commission, and these were people who had different philosophies, different political views, but they respected each other so much that they would give deference to each other's views and do their best to come to consensus judgments, and they did that. And with Foreign Corrupt Practices, that was certainly one of the issues that was difficult for them.
Were you all surprised by the number of companies that ended up coming forward under the disclosure program, or did you expect that there would be massive disclosure?
I was personally shocked by it, that it seemed to be endemic to the way American companies were doing business abroad. And maybe it was because I was young and naive, but it was shocking to me.
Well, it turns out you got a chance to help save the world after all, right?
A little bit.
A little bit, maybe. Okay. You work closely with the Department of Justice on that, or was this something that the SEC was mostly doing by itself?
We really didn't, at least the work that I was doing didn't involve the Justice Department at all. Okay. It was all initiated by the Commission. I presume that enforcement must have had more to do with the Justice Department. Mm-hmm.
Did CorpFin contribute to the debate over legislation that eventually led to the passage of the FCPA, or was that something that enforcement was working on with Congress? Or?
No, it was an interdisciplinary group, mm-hmm. Interdivisional. We all sat together and drafted the language and answered the congressional questions that came back. And it was clearly the effort of a large group of people at the commission.
Okay. You also worked on the Task Force on Corporate Governance during this period, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that task force came about?
Well, it started out being something much smaller. It started out being one of the periodic reviews of the proxy rules. And in the process of doing that, We started to look at some of the traditional corporate governance issues, the issues of what an independent director is, how you define independence. We looked at board composition and whether and to what extent the commission had jurisdiction to dictate what the composition should be. And then we looked at some of the broader issues like who owns the proxy machinery. Is this something that shareholders are entitled to use? And so we put out a very broad concept release. This must have been in 76 or 77. And we got back what at the time was a historic number of public comments, including my personal favorite, which was something to the effect that kid staffers and communists should all go back to Russia where they belonged, or you know, something like that, which
wow.
I hung on my wall for a while. At about the time that we were looking at these issues, Harold Williams became the chairman of the commission, and he was somebody who had an abiding interest in corporate governance. And so he suggested to us that we make it an even bigger project, and he suggested that we hold hearings around the country, which I think at that time had never been done by the commission before. So we had hearings in four or five cities around the country, and we had input from hundreds of people, some of whom were quite horrified at the notion that we were messing around with governance at all.
When you say some people, do you mean people in the corporations, on the boards, or were these just members of the public who were coming out and were very upset about this?
Well, the people who were the most upset were the representatives of the public companies, so people like the American Society of Corporate Secretaries that spoke for large numbers of public corporations, the Chamber of Commerce kinds of commentators, some of the bar associations. At the same time, Alibaba was doing a big corporate governance study, and they were looking at parallel issues and in some cases agreeing and in some cases disagreeing with the commission. We had a lot of academics who weighed in on the questions as to whether there was a federal corporate law in existence, whether this was something that we had the power to address, whether this was something that should be left to the industry and to the self-regulators. And what was so interesting about it is that all the passion that was expressed in the late 1970s was expressed again in a much later round that the commission initiated. In fact, the most recent round of proposals on corporate governance elicited a very similar reaction to the one that we had way back when.
Right.
So these are issues that that people care passionately about.
Mm-hmm. When you were formulating these new concepts, were you looking at the way that other countries around the world organize their business sectors, or were you just looking at the American sector and thinking, well, how could this be improved?
We really didn't look comparatively. I think we might have done a little bit of research about Germany, which has a very interesting approach to governance issues, but mostly
they have workers on the board, right?
They identify the constituencies that are affected by board actions, and they require that they be represented. But mostly, we were looking at the literature that related to the U.S. industry. We were more parochial then and less international. That was the way the world was in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm. And these two rulemaking projects, were they actually put out by the Task Force on Corporate Governance, or was that formed afterwards?
The proposals were put out by the Task
Force. By the Task Force, okay. So in 1979, you ended up leaving the commission, and I believe you ended up after that at the CFTC. Can you tell me a little bit of tell me the story of how you moved from the SEC to the CFTC?
Sure. The CFTC had been created in 1975, and it had gotten off to a somewhat rocky start. It was not perceived to be much of a regulator. And a man named Jim Stone, who had been the insurance commissioner in Massachusetts, came in to chair the agency in 1979, and he was reaching out to potential staff members in the hopes that he would be able to change the way the agency operated. And he came to me through Irv Pollack, actually, and asked me to be the director of something called the Office of Policy Review.
What did that office do?
Well, it's a good question. The general counsel of the agency under the Commodity Exchange Act worked specifically for the commission and not for the chairman. And so when the chairman wanted a project done, and he asked the general counsel to do it, the general counsel would say no. So my position was to be his lawyer, and when he asked me to do something, I said yes. And so that was what that position was.
Could you tell me a little bit about the difference in culture between the SEC and the CFTC, at least at this time?
Oh, it was completely different. The SEC had always been very puritanical. You know, we had metal desks and files piled up in the hallway and strict ethics rules. And the CFTC was much cozier with the industry that it regulated. The Chicago exchanges had a tremendous degree of access and clout at the commission. And the commission didn't perceive its mission in the same way. At the SEC, we knew we were there because we were concerned about investor protection. At the CFTC, the futures markets existed for the purpose of shifting risks from basically insiders who had information that enabled them to be on the right side of trades and shift that risk to outsiders. So I once made the mistake of including the phrase investor protection in a memo that I wrote. And members of the commission gave me a very hard time about it. No, that's not our mission. That's not what we do. At the time, the only prohibition in the statute against using inside information applied to employees of the CFTC. It didn't apply to anybody else in the futures markets, because the whole genesis of those markets was that a big industrial user of a commodity would know, you know, what the demand was going to be and would be able to profit from that information.
So, but how do they justify this? I mean, did they just claim that they were representing sophisticated investors, or how did that work?
Well, the people who would otherwise be considered investors had the dirty name speculator, you know, and speculators don't have to be protected. And in fact, there were not at the time that many individuals who were participating in the futures markets. Of course, the markets were changing very dramatically at that point because financial futures had only come into existence in 1975-76. So the nature of the markets, the nature of the instruments being traded, changed very dramatically in the late 70s and thereafter. The New York-based investment and commercial banks became major players in commodities. Commodity pools became very significant. So there was a lot that was changing, but the traditional way of thinking about futures was in a very laissez-faire mm-hmm. manner.
Yeah. So you were the director of the Office of Policy Review, but I also understand that you were the chief counsel to the CFTC's Division of Enforcement for a while too. Was that concurrently?
No, that was
okay.
later.
Okay, so you switched from one to the other. Yeah. So you mentioned some of these issues that were important at the time, like commodities pools and stock index futures. Could you tell me just a little bit about these issues and what you were doing on them?
Well, every contract that's traded on a futures exchange has to be approved by the commission in advance. And the whole idea that there could be futures contracts based on securities created all kinds of interesting issues as to potential manipulation, the effect of activity in one market on another, and raised all kinds of jurisdictional issues between the SEC and the CFTC. And several times over the years, there would be accords between the two agencies, and then the market would move past the accord. There would be some new instrument developed. So that was something that was ongoing. The growth of commodity pools was a jurisdictional issue because there was the question whether they had to be regulated by both the CFTC and the SEC, because a pooled investment vehicle is an investment company. And so there was dual regulation, but there were arguments over that. And there were arguments over virtually everything mm-hmm. that the two agencies did.
Yeah, another of the significant issues that at least when I was doing my research and looking at the newspaper articles from this period, at least it seems quite significant, was the question of stock index futures and who would regulate those.
Mm-hmm.
There was also sort of a jurisdictional clash between the CFTC and the SEC on this issue too, right?
There was a big clash between the two, although ultimately the SEC agreed that anything traded on a futures exchange should be regulated by the CFTC. And anything traded on the securities exchange should be regulated by the SEC. So you had, with stock futures originally, they had to be based on a broad index, and that was supposed to be the protection against manipulation based on the underlying. If you had a broad enough index, that was supposedly not going to happen. And that's the way the agencies dealt with that at the beginning. Ultimately, the indices became much narrower. Questions of manipulation did arise. There were differences in the definition of manipulation under the two statutes, where it was virtually impossible to prove manipulation under the Commodities Exchange Act. And so there were continuing jurisdictional issues.
Was the issue of control person liability also important at this time?
Well, it was a It was an issue that I got involved in when we were revising the statute and we were looking to see what protections the securities laws had that the commodities laws didn't have. And the commodities laws didn't have a controlling person liability provision. And in utter naivete and innocence, I said, well, let's put one in. You know, what's the big deal? It's always been the case in the securities law. And so we stuck it in a legislative package, and World War III erupted. It was one of the strangest reactions, because I think in the securities industry you think of controlling person liability as one more arrow in the quiver. It's not in and of itself that significant. It's pled in some cases in addition to other bases for liability. This was total war, and we wound up giving in on it. There was no way we could get it in the statute.
So who was arguing against this? Was it the commissioners, or was it the people in Congress, or what? Who?
It was the industry. It was the congressional staff people. Mm-hmm. You know, we were regulated by the agriculture committees that had a different sensibility than the banking and finance committees that the SEC had dealt with. So it was a big fiasco.
While you were at the CFTC, did you generally observe that there was a good relationship between the staff and the commissioners, or were the tensions at times?
Well, there were certainly tensions. There were factions on the commission, and so there were also factions, matching factions, parallel factions on the staff. Mm-hmm. And it was a contentious place to be in those years.
So a little bit different than your experience at the SEC.
Very, very different.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you spent a few years at the CFTC, and then you moved on to Citicorp next, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, and that was in 1983?
That's right.
All right. And can you tell me the story about how you got recruited by them, or how you ended up getting the position?
Well, they were looking for somebody who had experience in securities and commodities, and also municipal securities. And I was one of the only people in the universe at that time who had the combination of experiences that they were looking for. And so, and for me, it was coming home. I had grown up in New York, and I was very happy about coming back to New York. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what was your title? Were you general counsel at that point?
I was, at the beginning, I was the general counsel of something that was called the Money Market Division, and I subsequently became the general counsel of the investment bank, mm-hmm. Which included the activities, the fixed income derivatives, structured finance, futures, municipal securities, and foreign currency operations of the organization. In the early years, I was responsible for those activities in the United States, and then at some point in time, I became responsible for those activities in the OECD countries. So it was a big job and an exciting job at a time when what banks were doing in the securities industry was changing very dramatically.
There were obviously a lot of different issues that you were working on, but just maybe briefly, can you tell me what those changes were that were going on in commercial banking?
Well, banks were fighting very hard to get rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated investment and commercial banking from 1933 on. And they were proceeding on a number of fronts, working with regulators to carve out activities that were considered incidental to banking, whether or not they involved securities. Working with the Federal Reserve to take advantage of what some people call the loophole in the statute. Banks could be could not be affiliated with a company that was principally engaged in certain prohibited securities businesses. So by inference, they could be affiliated with somebody who wasn't principally engaged in those businesses. And so we were able to get the Federal Reserve to act on what we called Section 20 applications and expand our securities-related activities. There was a lot of litigation going on in those years and also a lot of attempts to get legislation through Congress. It wound up taking decades to get the legislation passed, but all through the 80s and 90s, before the legislation was passed, there were major, major initiatives that were successful.
Let's go back. You mentioned that the Federal Reserve changed its rules to allow bank holding companies to underwrite some of these different types of securities, right? Mm-hmm. I think this was in 1987, is that correct?
The first orders were in 1987, yes.
Okay. How did the Reagan administration feel about this? I mean, did you have sympathetic allies there?
We really didn't work with the administration.
Okay.
And although in Congress we had more support from Republican members mm-hmm. of the banking committees than from Democrats, but it wasn't, strictly speaking, a partisan issue. It was, when you're choosing between the commercial banking industry and the investment banking industry, it was a source of lobbying income for a lot of members of the House and Senate for a very long time. The committees in both houses that dealt with these issues were the largest committees in either house. Everybody wanted to be on them. Everybody wanted this fight to go on forever and ever. So it was interesting. It was an interesting way to learn about the legislative process.
Mm-hmm. Who were the groups that were arguing against changing these rules? I mean, who was for the status quo?
The people for the status quo were the investment banks and the trade associations that represented them. So most of the litigation was undertaken by what was then called the SIA, mm-hmm. The Securities Industry Association, and the other organization that litigated quite a bit was the Investment Company Institute, mm-hmm. because the same fight was taking place in the asset management business as in the brokerage industry.
What sorts of arguments were they making against changing the rules for?
Well, the arguments were that the reason for Glass-Steagall was to prevent the subtle hazards that created dangers for the banking system. And the other arguments had to do with the riskiness to banks of securities-related activities.
Mm-hmm.
Those arguments really were not valid arguments, because a lot of the things that were permissible for banks, like buying and selling loans, were actually riskier than buying and selling debt securities, because mm-hmm. at the time loans were illiquid, and whereas debt securities were highly liquid. So it was a bunch of arguments that really had been bypassed by changes in the industry and the passage of time.
Right, so they were making those arguments, but from the perspective of the commercial banks, the investment banks were just trying to protect their own turf.
Of course, it was
right?
a competitive
okay.
issue.
This was in, so in 1987, the Federal Reserve started to change the rules a little bit. That was also the same year that the S&L crisis happened. Did that have any impact on efforts to change or to break down these walls between commercial and investment banking? Did it slow it down at all? Or?
It actually didn't, although you might ask why that was the case,
right.
Because one of the differences in the law that applied to S&Ls was that they were allowed to trade anything. But for some reason, it never played into the political debate on Glass-Steagall,
mm-hmm.
and
no one thought of that argument.
Well, I think that there was a perception that the S&L crisis really was a result of bad regulation,
right.
and lax regulation, and so it didn't flow over into the Glass-Steagall debate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mentioned that the commercial banks used a series of court cases to challenge some of these rules. Could you tell me a little bit about some of them?
One of the big cases was involved Security Pacific, mm-hmm. which at the time was one of the major banks. And the question was whether they could take mortgages that they either originated or bought and sold and package them into mortgage-backed securities. And that was something that the bank regulators had permitted banks to do for some period of time. And the court that considered the SECPAC case agreed that that was permissible. We had a similar case that Citi was involved in out of a Delaware state court, where we packaged up mortgages mm-hmm. not into pass-through securities, but into CMO securities where the cash flows didn't exactly match the underlying mortgages. And that was considered legally to be a different issue because mm-hmm. it wasn't a mere pass-through of the underlying mortgage cash streams. And so that required more litigation, mm-hmm. and we were successful on that.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, the Security Pacific case was originally, their attempt to underwrite these securities was originally rejected by a court, and then that was later overturned, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And then in the news reporting at the time, this Delaware case was seen as sort of a challenge to that, or an attempt to push
yes.
back against that ruling.
And it was.
So
it
okay.
Was.
So that was sort of the strategy at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a lot of fun too.
Right. Yeah. So so relations between say the people at Citicorp and the SIA were not very good at this time, were they?
Well, we were all doing business with each
right,
other,
right.
But there was certainly litigation going on, and so if you were choosing a law firm to represent you in a commercial bank, it was unlikely to be a law firm that was handling the litigation on behalf of the SIA in mm-hmm. a Glass-Steagall-related case.
Yeah.
But you know, we were all the major players in all kinds of businesses and doing business together.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that the Congress got a little bit interested in the Delaware case as well. I saw some news articles in which John Dingell had said that he wanted to have a criminal investigation of Citicorp. Maybe exaggerating a little bit, but...
Yeah, John Dingell did say things like that from time to time, but there was no such investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, was there any thought during this period that, well, the end of Glass-Steagall might be near, or that there might be possible to push for legislation that would change that, or were you not so ambitious at the time?
Yeah, we always believed that it was inevitable that it would be repealed, and there were several legislative sessions where repeal legislation passed one house and not the other. So we knew it was close, we just didn't know when it was going to occur. And there was also a growing level of comfort that the banks could do what they wanted to do, what they cared most about doing, without changing Glass-Steagall. So, you know, the one thing that banks couldn't do with Glass-Steagall in place was do equity underwriting and trading. And that's something they got into a much bigger way later on.
At the end of the 90s.
Yeah.
Of course, during these years, the move into underwriting securities was not the only change going on in commercial banking. This was also the era in which derivatives and structured finance began to take shape in their modern form. Can you tell me a little bit about how that looked from the perspective of Citicorp?
Yeah, Citicorp was one of the early movers in those businesses, and was the training ground for the people who went out and ran those businesses all over the street. And at the time, these seemed like the most wonderful innovations. You know, the derivatives business was a way for risks to be shifted. So if you were an operating company and you had exposure to foreign currency fluctuations because you'd issued debt denominated in yen and you weren't in the business of managing yen risk, you could enter into a swap with Citi or one of the other banks. And it made a tremendous amount of sense, and there was a tremendous appetite for these products in the interest rate arena and also in currencies, and then later on in commodities and credit derivatives. And we thought we had created something of great value, something that really served customers' purposes and that created great business opportunities. The same thing was true with structured finance. We developed the methodology to bundle up different kinds of assets. So at the beginning, it was mortgages and credit card receivables and car receivables, and ultimately it was assets of every description, including things as esoteric as taxi medallions that you could package up and you could sell to investors. And by doing that, you were able to free up the capital so that the bank could then re-lend money. It was a great stimulus to the mortgage business and to all kinds of consumer lending businesses. And we were very, very proud of our ability to do this. Mm-hmm. And I never would have guessed that these instruments would be at the center of a financial crisis. Mm-hmm.
Did these new instruments come under much scrutiny at this time, either from the Congress or from the SEC or from other organizations?
They came under scrutiny in the sense that developing these products raised new accounting issues, raised tax issues. There were very specific esoteric SEC issues because these things were done as registered securities, but there were funny investment company issues, whether you were creating an inadvertent investment company, things like mm-hmm. that. But nobody looked at them with a view of preventing them from being sold. They were regarded as positive developments mm-hmm. economically.
Yeah. I know that during the 90s, the FASB dealt with this issue a lot, the accounting issues. And the big question was, well, how do you account for this in the books, not whether or not you should actually
right.
have these.
Right. That was the focus. There was also there was one major enforcement case in the 90s, and that was against Bankers Trust. It was an enforcement action brought by the SEC, the CFTC, the Fed, and the New York State Banking Department. And it came out of Bankers Trust selling very exotic derivatives to its customers. It based the rates on something called LIBOR cubed or LIBOR squared, and so you had a reference rate that didn't correlate to any risk that anybody actually had, and that was so highly leveraged that when it went against you, it caused major losses. So that was the big black eye for the derivatives business in that period of time. But to answer your question, no, nobody tried to prevent these instruments from being developed. And they were viewed by bank regulators as being part of the business of banking, because if a bank had the intrinsic right to set rates on loans and to set rates on deposits, then it was also viewed as incidental to that power that it could do interest rate derivatives, and the same analysis took place on currencies, on credit, on other categories of derivative instruments.
Okay, I'd like to come back to this subject in just a minute, but first let's talk a little bit about your career since Citicorp. What year did you end up leaving the organization?
I left Citi in 1997.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. I left Citi in 1991, and then I went to Cadwallader, and I was a partner there mm-hmm. until 1997.
Okay. And what did you do in 1997?
In 1997, I decided I had had enough of finance, and I went off and I pursued other interests, including fiction writing.
Uh-huh. Did any of your fiction concern finance? Any financial thrillers?
Absolutely not.
Found it. Okay. But eventually you came back into the sphere of finance, and you began working with consulting and risk management services?
Yes.
And that was in 2003, I understand?
Yeah.
Okay. What sorts of issues did you work on there?
From 2003 until 2010, I worked with a company called Capital Markets Risk Advisors that was a boutique risk management firm. And we worked with different players in the financial services, businesses, asset management companies, hedge funds, broker-dealers, pension funds, all kinds of market participants in reviewing their risk management and helping them improve their risk management. And I also worked in litigation support as an expert witness in litigation that raised issues coming out of trading businesses, sometimes with respect to things like whether the risk management used by one of the participants in the lawsuit was comparable to best practices, a whole range of issues. And in 2010, I left that firm and with my husband Richard Ness, and we created Luness Partners, and we do risk management and compliance consulting, and we also do litigation support.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you something. So you took some time off in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and then came back into the financial services industry. Did you notice any changes, maybe in the culture of the industry or the way that things operated, or was it business as usual?
I think it got a little bit. I think it got a little bit more aggressive, more of a Wild West atmosphere. I think as the result of the growth of hedge funds, which typically have less in the way of controls than the older, more established investment banks and commercial banks. So there are a lot of market participants who might have been very savvy traders, but they didn't know very much about risk management, they didn't know very much about compliance. Most of them were really non-regulated. And at the same time that there was a Wild West atmosphere in the markets were becoming much more complicated. So mm-hmm. You had instruments that were of a complexity that had really not existed mm-hmm. earlier on. And I think a lot of that played into what sadly happened in 2008 and afterwards.
Did you ever think back and wonder, well, did we create a monster when we were pioneering all these new types of financial instruments?
I've asked myself that question because so much of my life's work involved derivatives and structured finance and the repeal of Glass-Steagall, all things that that have been pointed at as having some role in the crisis. I think we laid the foundation, but I don't think that those instruments or the repeal of Glass-Steagall intrinsically really caused what happened. I think what caused the results that we all saw was a combination of things. One was that the products were so complicated that I think nobody in the institution selling them really knew what they were doing. And I think the money was so big that it became impossible for a control person to say no. In my days in banking, you could not do a transaction or a deal if you didn't have the credit sign off, if you didn't have the legal sign off, if you didn't have the accounting sign off. And I think the pressures mounted so that the control people were really rolled over in the 2000s, and had they been listened to, I think a lot of the problems would have been obviated.
Okay. Yeah. Have you worked much with the SEC over the last, 10 years or so since you came back into the industry?
A little bit. I've done things like being a special examiner after a settlement of an enforcement action. I'm not so much representing clients in front of the commission mm-hmm. anymore, I do create compliance programs for clients. So I have some sense of the commission, but it's not as immediate as, okay. as when I was there and when I was bringing clients in on a regular basis. Right.
I wanted to ask you whether you had noticed a change in the commission from back in the 70s when you worked there to today.
Well, what's obvious just from reading the papers is that the collegiality that was so prevalent at the commission is a thing of the past, and it has become so common for commissioners to speak out publicly about their dissent on decisions. There seems to be a great lack of civility. The commission certainly has been under tremendous fire. When I was there in the 70s, we were always regarded as the best agency in Washington, and it was an agency that prided itself on its independence. Whenever there was an attempt by an administration to affect policy, the administration was rebuffed. People took tremendous pride in being part of the commission, tremendous pride in having that on their resume for the rest of their careers. And I think, sadly, that some of that has been lost, and I don't know whether it can be regained. But it was such a potent tool, and it really changed the way securities laws were administered in this country, because you had a cadre of hundreds of alumni who went out and really felt a special obligation mm-hmm. to uphold these laws and to make sure that their clients did the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that was a wonderful tool.
That's an interesting observation, because so many young people do go and work for the SEC for a few years before staking out on their own or going into the private sphere. I think it's a very common experience. Do you think that at the time you were there was a conscious effort by either the members of the commission or the staff members to sort of cultivate younger staff members to go off and embody these values in their own careers?
It was very explicit, and the man who did it in the most effective way was Irv Pollack, but other senior officials of the agency did the same thing. And as a result of that, the voice that I hear in my head to this day when I have a difficult decision to make is Irv Pollack's voice, and the question I ask myself is a variation on the question that he and Stanley taught young lawyers to ask. They said, always ask yourself how you would feel if what you're doing today was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal tomorrow. The question I ask myself is, what would Irv and Stanley think if I make this decision the wrong way? And it's been a very potent voice in my head, and I feel very lucky that it's there.
Okay, now I'd like to ask you about another subject that you've become involved with over the last few years, microfinance. Can you tell me how you became interested in microfinance?
Now you're getting to the things that I feel passionate about. Microfinance. I learned about microfinance 5 or 6 years ago. I was part of an organization of women in the hedge fund industry that raises money for philanthropy, and we were looking at potential beneficiaries, and we decided to look at some microfinance organizations. I had never heard of microfinance before that, but as I started to learn about it, I became passionate about the power of microfinance, and I traveled through West Africa and I saw it on the ground, spoke to a lot of people who were involved in it. And microfinance is a way of helping people help themselves. It's not charity. It's extending credit to people who have some existing business activity, albeit very small. And it enables people, and particularly women, to become economically self-sufficient. I always say that poverty is not a women's issue per se, but more than 50% of the world's poor people are women. And when a woman has the ability to support herself and her family, several things happen immediately. The woman sends her children to school as soon as it's possible, and she gets health care for her family, and the nutrition in the home improves, and the whole community benefits. Rates of HIV infection go down. Life gets better for everyone. And as I've had the opportunity in recent years to travel the world and see microfinance on many continents, it's the same everywhere. You ask a microfinance client how her life has been affected, and she tells you about her children. And in one generation, a woman has gone from selling goods off the dirt floor or building a small kiosk with plywood to sending her children to high school and beyond. And it's something that I am very proud and happy to be involved in. I chair a small microfinance organization in Ghana.
What's the name of the organization?
It's called Women's Trust, and we work in a village outside of Accra, and we make loans to women, and we have scholarships for girls and health education, and it's really one of the most rewarding things that I do. I'm also on the board of a big global organization called Axiom, which sets the standard in microfinance, which develops best practices and helps build the premier microfinance organizations in the world.
Is there a role for something like regulation in microfinance? Is there an equivalent of that? I mean, obviously there's not an SEC that's going to go out and regulate microfinance markets. How does that work?
Well, it's regulated in some countries, and actually one of the things that makes the microfinance business better and more investable is to have it regulated. The difficulty is getting regulators to understand the difference between microfinance and commercial banking, because although there are great similarities, there are also major differences. So what's appropriate in capital requirements for a commercial bank isn't the same as what's appropriate in microfinance. But to have regulation enhances the credibility of the organization. In Ghana, microfinance has been regulated since last January, and we welcomed it because it means that we have past somebody's scrutiny.
Yeah. So regulation in that sense means that the microfinance organization is maybe registered as an organization as such and has to maintain capital requirements?
Has to maintain capital, is subject to government inspection. It's different all over the world. The thing that makes microfinance regulation difficult in some places is limits on interest rates, because microloans are expensive to administer. Yeah. So there can be difficulties if the caps are too low. There can also be difficulties in some countries where a populist government facing re-election will suddenly declare that nobody has to repay their loans. And this is very damaging to microfinance and to the borrowers, because once the election is over, the government's not giving away money, and private institutions aren't coming in so quickly. Mm-hmm. So those are the regulatory issues that we see.
I'm sorry to ask so many specific questions, but as far as the World Bank, do they have guidelines for microfinance organizations and things like that? Or?
No, they don't. But there are groups that have banded together, industry groups that have formulated best practice concepts and principles. Mm-hmm. That's something that has actually been spearheaded by something called the Center for Financial Inclusion that is funded by Axiom. And so there are principles that good microfinance institutions follow.
All right, Ms. Lucas. Well, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.